William C. Dennis is Senior Program Officer at Liberty Fund in Indianapolis. It is well known to most of the members of this society who have, I suspect, at one time or another have participated in its programs and its seminars. Bill studied at Earlham College and later at Yale, where his doctoral dissertation was on the Connecticut Federalists. He taught history for many years at Denison University. His department chairman there once said in his presence, as Bill reported it to me some years ago, "Our department is so strong we can afford a conservative." Well, Bill eventually went off to the Reagan administration for a few years before joining the Liberty Fund. When time permits, he has always liked to climb mountains or otherwise lose himself in the wilderness, but his time has been rather precious recently. Much of it given to imparting a love of liberty and a love of the wilderness to his one-year-old son. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Dennis.
You can see on your sheet, as John said, way down here it says Southerners and Others. Well, I think mostly I'm the other. Evidently was brought here, at least partly for that purpose. I think my remarks are such that they might have fit in better to the morning panel than the one we have today, because I want to talk about the Civil War again. And there is something secretly pleasing about an old Yankee like myself to come down to Charleston and talk about the Civil War, particularly the way I'm going to do it.
First, get the title right.
Exactly my point. What would really be fun is to have enough time afterwards to talk about some of those important issues with all of you, and maybe we'll have some time for some questions. So anyway, let me see what I can do. I have a simple point, and I'm going to make it quickly. In 1861, I'm going to try to comment on the number of different people who've said a few things previously in the course of our meeting. In 1861, our great conservative nation broke apart and fell into civil war, largely because the Southern leadership had forgotten how much they shared in common with their Yankee brethren. They became convinced, wrongly, that the election of Lincoln to the presidency brought to power a rationalistic, majoritarian, leveling conspiracy in the guise of the Republican Party, intent on destroying the Southern way of life, a code phrase too often, I believe, for the preservation of slavery, a position that you can see something of in Mel Bradford's words when he wrote, "Since the time when churches all across the North rang their bells to mourn the death of that murderous fanatic, John Brown of Pottawatomie, we have been a nation threatened with any and every measure brought forth in the name of metaphysical equality." So I pause in noting that the Republican platform of 1860 condemned John Brown. But I would argue, in contrast to this Southern line, that with the Southern demand after the Dred Scott decision for a federal slave code for the territories, and for a vicious fugitive slave law, the enforcement of the vicious fugitive slave law of 1850, and a demand for this federal slave code based in part upon their newfound scientific understanding of innate Negro inferiority, and after a thoughtless and ill-tempered secession by South Carolina following the wholly constitutional presidential election of 1860, a case could be made, indeed if I had more time I would love to make it further, that it was the Southern seceders and not the modern Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln, which represented the rationalistic arguers from definition intent on radical reform of the conservative republic that Mel Bradford so rightly condemns. When Lincoln cited the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, He was not making some theoretical rationalistic argument detached from historical reality. He was merely stating a fact. Men were equal. Not equal in the sense of equally articulate, or equally wise, or equally smart, or equally fit, or equally diligent, but equal in the sense that all being men, there were not reasonable arguments why one man should own another, nor govern another, other than the argument from force, that is, that man had the power and the desire to so rule or so own. But the argument from power was not a defensible one in the American Republic of 1776, or in 1787, or in 1860, or in 1994. Now, this statement may be an argument from definition of a sort, but not all such arguments are radical, nor are they necessarily wrong. When South Carolina broke the bonds of union, Southerners or Northern Democrats with Southern sympathies had filled the office of president through the entire course of the Republic, except for the two terms of the Adamses, the brief administration of Millard Fillmore. A similar situation existed with the Supreme Court, with the speakers of the House, with the great military leaders of the nation, and the vast majority of the federal establishment in Washington. Without secession, Southern allies would still have dominated the United States Senate. On all the great political issues of the early Republic, what had come to be known as the Southern position had prevailed. States' rights, a low tariff, no national bank, few internal improvements at national expense, easy access to settlement in the public lands. Lincoln promised a conservative regime, pledged only to one radical position, and that was a correct one. No further expansion of slavery. A position based on the clear power acknowledged by many Southern leaders in the past, that the national government had the right to legislate in this area for the national territory. Having that right, it seems to me, it had a duty by 1860. So we came to understand slavery better, to do something about it, to put it on the way to extinction. Other Republican positions may have been inadvisable, and I think their Republican economic platform largely was. But they were standard Whiggish positions, and hardly radical or outside the American political tradition as we have known it for 75 years. If the South stayed in the Union, conservative, traditional government might well continue for decades to come. Now, when General Roebuck this morning gave her very interesting, provocative summary of her wonderful new book, she said that South Carolinians could count, and it was important for them to learn to do so. And I said to her afterwards, and I now say to you now, the problem was they didn't count very well. They could have, except for the question of slavery, continue to rely upon substantial allies in the North, and that would have been a good thing for all of us still today if they had done so. Now, as you all know, the view I've just outlined was not the view of Emmy Bradford. At this point, I was going to quote the very passage from the reactionary imperative that Sam Francis just gave us. So let me pass on beyond that and the analogy of Cromwell. Just to give you a line of Bradford's on Lincoln. Lincoln, Bradford said, did not save the Union as it was. Rather, he played the central role in transforming it forever into a unitary structure based upon a claim to power in its own right, a teleocratic instrument which, in the name of any cause that attracts a following, might easily threaten the liberties of those for whose sake it existed. And as those of us who've spent some time with Dr. Bradford know that that's a mild, scholarly appraisal of Lincoln compared to what he was capable of saying. Now, I had the privilege of arguing with Mel a good bit about this point, and I don't want to press too hard my disagreements with Lincoln, partly because he taught me to be much more cautious, skeptical in my evaluation of Lincoln than I previously would have been. I do agree with him now that Lincoln was partly responsible for the transformation of the Union into the centralist republic that we have today. But he was hardly alone in that, and I think the major blame comes to not Lincoln, but to the war. And I think the war is clearly a problem for the South. It was their war. and it need not have come. What I would like to do, and maybe we can talk about that a little more in the discussion, what I would like to do is to show you some evidence now that Mel perhaps had come to reevaluate his own understanding of New England, and through that reevaluation had come to see more merit in the view that America in 1860 was indeed a conservative republic, North and South, and it was still so in 1861, and it was still worth saving then and now. Now, evidence for this proposition is spotty, and my time is short, and I'm not altogether convinced by the argument myself. But let me give you some interesting quotations of some sorts that we haven't heard here from our commentators so far. Let me give you what Mel's appraisal of the New England founders actually was. Here, for instance, is Mel Bradford of Samuel Adams, normally thought as one of the radical founders. Contrary to Tory propaganda, he was never an egalitarian, always spoke of subordination as necessary to the purposes of government, and thought utopian schemes of leveling and a community of goods as bad as the tyranny of wicked monarchs. Or in Peter Sedgwick of Massachusetts, intrepid high federalist, Bradford called him, quote, a relentless enemy of all rabble-rousers, politics of philosophy and theories and so much talk of equality, committed to order and degree. Or in Samuel Livermore of New Hampshire, a cautious, moderate man, but also a friend of order, hence a Federalist of the local-minded variety. I don't think there were any other Federalists like that, of any other variety except for Alexander Hamilton. A Federalist of the local-minded variety who eschewed the abstract and the doctrinaire. Furthermore, he doubted the validity of natural rights theory, connecting it with the relinquishment of all law that contradicted or thwarted the passions and desires of its advocates. Or Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts, whose Federalism exhibited no ideological passion, no commitment to the grand abstractions of natural right theory. Or Rufus King of Massachusetts and New York, absolute horror of political abstractions. To him, equality meant the unnatural genius of his age, the arch enemy of the moral world, essentially a parochial spirit, a predictable product of his New England upbringing. Exactly right. Or Roger Sherman of Connecticut, the summary representative of the decentralist sentiments of the state's ordinary citizens, who warned that the Constitution should lay as few temptations as possible in the way of those in power. With Sherman, there emerges a very minimal sort of federal government, neither energetic nor democratic. An Oliver Ellsworth, Connecticut, unusual among his New England brethren. I don't think he was, but I would say he was usual. But Mel said unusual among his New England brethren, in recognizing that all Americans did not and would not share in one system of values. We know, Ellsworth said in Philadelphia, that the people of the states are strongly attached to their own constitution. If you hold up a system of governmental destruction of their constitutional rights, they will oppose it. And there are many other examples of Mel and the founders similar to these. In his wonderful essay, A Dyke Defense Out the Flood, the Ratification of the Constitution in Massachusetts, Mel finds a people more to his liking than he cares to admit. Quote, from the first, what worked most against the Federalist cause, that is, in this case, the ratification of the Constitution, not the Federalist Party that come later. What worked most against the Federalist cause had been Massachusetts's fierce insularity, a powerful spirit of localism, the advantage belonging to well-tested manners, modes, and orders, the general American fear of remote and hostile authorities compounded in the third power by an intended pride in being part of a chosen people, and the proposition that the interests of the states are too dissimilar for a union. To that proposition, that the interests of the states are too dissimilar for a union, Federalists say little more than that the members of the southern states, like ourselves, have their prejudice. On the Constitution itself, which was a collaborative act of conservative North and South, Bradford writes that it was a limited, political, non-philosophical act, reflecting the consensus about the nation's future hopes and present character, performed by men whose agreements with one another grew in the process of hammering out certain differences of opinion about the common good in relationship to the particular good of their own communities. And in original intentions, Radford wrote, "In a regime of independent freeholders, commercial men, and self-governing communities who had negotiated informally their own version of the civil compact, one they could good, in good heart defend together without rewriting their common past, without any hope of reforming one another, such a balance as possible, a federal balance, as that term signified to them." So they reassured one another with tiresome iteration concerning the framers of these essays of his in original intentions, have with the same kind of emphasis demonstrated that despite their many other differences, limited government as opposed to anarchic freedom was uniformly their objective. Evidence to that effect we should take seriously, even when we are personally inclined to think another way, for the alternative is dishonesty and contempt for the law. These new men of New England, the fathers and grandfathers of those who contested with the South in 1860, and I think it is worth all of us, particularly this audience today, ponder the question, how did such men become enemies of the South over the course of just one lifetime? And I would suggest to you that they had not become enemies, and that they should not have gone to war. Now, of course, things had changed by 1861. For one thing, the Republic was no longer an untried experiment, such as the sort the Founding Fathers all commented on and worried about. We had shared in a great deal over the course of that lifetime. And I suggest to you that, except for slavery, there would have been no secession. Slavery was wrong, the South knew it was wrong, and it was an ignoble cause to defend as a matter of principle and honor. But it was the secession and the war which followed, along with much Republican meddling over the subsequent 50 years, that set the stage for the next Southern president, Woodrow Wilson, whose banner flies outside the Jefferson Hotel in Richmond, Virginia, along with the other Virginia presidents, to finally bring the conservative republic your needs. And our tragedy lies in that administration and not in that of Abraham Lincoln. Now, I think Mel understood this tragedy of conservative division quite well. In his introduction from Eden to Babylon, the Social and Political Essays of Andrew Lively writes, "The appearance of From Eden to Babylon reminds us that there is another conservatism, one which the framers would have recognized. According to this tradition, the defeat of the South in 1865 destroyed not only the South, but the initial sense of itself that describes the federation of the states, society after the American Revolution. The vision of the agrarians did not presume that culture or politics poured in from the top. The virtue of private property is not wealth, but its capacity to resist Leviathan and to secure the peace of the family." And that sort of conservatism indeed was the conservatism of the agrarian republic in states like New York, where John Wilson's ancestors came from, or Indiana, where mine did. They too were part of that agrarian republic, and they too were part of that American conservatism. The boys who confronted each other at Shiloh and at Gettysburg and at all the other hollow grounds of mystic memory were wonderful exemplars of that conservatism. That was their tragedy and ours, that the Union did not hold and that the conservative consensus did not prevail. So let me bring these remarks to a close by first reinforcing McDonald to my aid. See him in the corner here, probably grimacing at all my remarks. And then one final quotation from a friend we honor here today. Forrest writes in his foreword to Bradford's original intentions on the making and ratification of the United States Constitution, following, "One final comment seems in order. Though the story of the perversion of the original Constitution is a sad and potentially tragic one, Bradford writes in hope, not in despair. His message, that of a quintessential Southerner, can perhaps best be described by quoting the words of a quintessential Yankee, Daniel Webster. Miracles do not cluster. Hold on to the Constitution of the United States of America and the Republic for which it stands. What has happened once in 6,000 years may never happen again. Hold on to your Constitution, for if the American Constitution shall fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world." And now to Mill, from his collection of essays, The Reactionary Imperatives. imperative, which Sam Francis also quoted from recently. I have been slow to recognize that there was anything conservative about belonging to the party of hope. One of the lessons of the Reagan years is that avoiding the sin of despair with an optimistic conviction that hope and life go together is not the same thing as hard millenarianism, I'm sorry about that, and is furthermore definitely American. Not being so burdened by history that we cannot climb up to the shining city. If we remember what makes despair a sin and an insult to our Creator, we will better understand why American conservatism is often cheerful and is that way for religious reasons. As we contemplate the future, we should not repeat the mistakes of 1860. We should remember that we need not have 100% agreement on fundamental principles, or upon tactics, or upon prudential questions, to make cheerful common cause with all of those who know that the great political problem of our time is that Leviathan must be rechained. This is our battle today, and we need not continued sectarianism nor uncritical unity, but thoughtful alliance in the long struggle to come. And so at the end of my remarks, I guess I would like to associate myself with the ending few minutes of Eugene Genovese's remarks as well. And I hope in doing so, associate myself with the best of Mel Bradford. Thanks very much, John.